On November 3rd, Utah voters will decide the fates of seven propositions to amend Utah's constitution. Among them is an amendment that would change the current dedication of income tax revenues to include other possible uses. Coupled with its companion legislation, it could have significant impacts on the way education is funded in Utah. In this podcast, we discuss that amendment, as well as six other propositions on the ballot. This is Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichard. In mid-October, Utah Foundation released a report called On the Ballot. The report provided unbiased analysis of the seven propositions to amend the Constitution. Utah Foundation did not take a position for or against any of those items. The purpose of the report was merely to give voters a brief, objective overview and analysis of each item, wrapping up with what would happen if voters approve or reject them. Utah Foundation Vice President Sean Tigan, Research Analyst Christopher Collard, and I sat down to discuss these items. First, there's Amendment A. This is to change language in the Constitution that applies to a single gender. Would you categorize this, gentleman, as simply a cleanup?
There are a whole 237 sections in the Utah Constitution, and six of them are still using these male pronouns, and it's a very simple cleanup.
Okay, that's Amendment A. Let's move on to Amendment B, dealing with legislator age requirement.
Yeah, certainly. So in Davis County, we had a candidate running for office that was 24 years old, and the question was, did that candidate need to be 25 at the time that the filing deadline, which is in March, or did they have to be 25 at the time of the November election, or when that candidate assumed office in January? And so this is basically just saying, when do you have to be the age that you need to be to qualify for this office? When do you need to live in your district? When do you need to be a citizen of the United States and so forth, just to make sure that people are clear on when they qualified for candidacy.
What is the clarification? What point in the process?
So the clarification is you need to be qualified to be a candidate at the time of election or appointment for office.
And this applies to the legislative branch. The state executive offices, such as attorney general, lieutenant governor, and governor, already have this same requirement in place. So it's merely bringing the requirements regarding legislative members to the same standard that already exists for executive offices.
Thanks, Christopher. Let's move on to Amendment C. This is to remove slavery as punishment for a crime. I'm not sure how to categorize this one. It certainly raises one's eyebrows that we currently have a provision in the Constitution that allows for slavery and involuntary servitude as a criminal punishment. But as a practical matter, what does this change, Sean?
You know, very little. I think that if you're going to categorize this one, it could almost be in some ways categorized like the first one, but this is more of a modernization bill, I guess, to an amendment to really bring, you know, Utah up into the 21st century, I suppose. So basically, it's not going to change much of anything. The Utah Department of Corrections, they're in support of the amendment. They figure that this is not going to change anything in terms of how they approach their practices in prisons. And it's just simply a modernization to get that kind of crazy word out of the Utah Constitution.
Christopher, anything to add on this one?
You might just classify it as adjusting the laws to reflect status quo practices.
And maybe it's an update just to reflect the morals and kind of ethical kind of positions of people today.
Yeah, the modern sensibilities, I suppose. We should clarify that by slavery, it wasn't meant to legalize slavery in Utah. I mean, this was
provision from well after the abolition of slavery proper. This is just merely applying to prisoners, a term of art that we would certainly not use if we wanted to have a similar law in place today. Let's move on to Amendment D, Municipal Water Resources. Christopher, why was this amendment necessary?
As the Valley kind of grew over the past century, water providers have at times provided water to people outside of municipal districts. The largest example is Salt Lake City, which services several communities nearby. And so what this does is this merely updates constitutional language to kind of formalize the practice of a city offering water services to those outside of its municipal boundaries, and kind of applies the same laws that apply to it providing water inside the municipal boundaries to the, you know, kind of the same standards to providing water outside of those boundaries. And so mainly this is just kind of formalizing a practice that's been happening for the past several decades.
What would happen if voters voted against this? I mean, if voters rejected this amendment?
It would kind of leave up this question of how can Salt Lake City purchase or get rid of or trade water sources when those water sources are either outside of its municipal boundaries or serving people outside of those municipal boundaries. The law is very clear about what it can do with its own water sources within its boundaries, but it's less clear and kind of leaves open this case for potential lawsuits for those outside of the boundaries.
This is in the category of clearing up an ambiguity or potential ambiguity.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Amendment E. This one maybe was a little spicier in public discussions. Amendment E is guarantee in the Constitution the right to hunt and fish in Utah. What does this change, or does it change anything, Sean?
If we're categorizing bills, this might be in the kind of messaging category, though the sponsor suggests that maybe it's a category where we're looking forward to future generations and some potential detrimental effects on people's right to hunt fish in the future. Right now, it would do nothing. I mean, basically, Utah would just join the ranks of about half of the states that either have a right to hunt or fish or hunt and fish. It basically would still mean that hunting and fishing is restricted by statute and current laws and regulations on the books. But what it would do potentially in the future, according to the sponsor, is what if, you know, a whole bunch of Californians came into Utah and said, hey, we don't want people actually hunting or fishing here. Let's get a vote on the ballot. This would basically say, hey, you know, you can't vote down people's right to hunt fish. You'd actually have to go in and change the Constitution to do that.
So it's kind of a preemptive or protective type of amendment.
Yeah, and for this theoretical, you know, different population that might be in Utah in the 2050s, let's say.
Sure. Christopher, what were you going to say?
Isn't California one of the other states that guarantees the right to fish?
Yeah, but not hunt. And that's actually one of the points that the sponsor brought up, is that, you know, California, they passed this right to fish, but not hunt. So are they going to try to take away
our right to hunt? Yeah. I guess one other thing that comes to mind, just to clarify about this, while people will still have the right to hunt, it doesn't mean people can trespass, or it doesn't, you know, deny people's property rights. It doesn't deny the state's ability to set regulations regarding hunting. But one interesting fact that this does do is it also puts in the Constitution that public hunting and fishing shall be the preferred means of managing and controlling wildlife. Currently, there's nothing regarding how the Department of Wildlife Resources should kind of manage habitat or wildlife right now. So they kind of have a flexible means to do whatever they think works best. This does very much formalize it and make it part of the Constitution. So it would be very hard for them to do anything else if there was ever a reason to.
I don't know if it would restrict the right to do other things. It would just restrict the right to make some other thing the preferred method, I would suggest.
I think we might run into problems over like how we define a preferred method.
Nope, right.
That's the beauty of constitutional amendments, right? The more you amend, the more you have to amend because of the unforeseen future interpretation.
And so I guess just for clarification, like it's not a whole lot different of how the state currently manages habitat. You know, it is primarily through hunting and fishing, but it does add additional future restrictions.
So my question is, what would the alternative be? Would we send in drones to go scour the woods and eliminate excess wildlife?
That's still hunting. That's just drone. That'd be drone hunting.
Thinking of wild horses in Utah, hasn't it been discussed of shooting horses from helicopters, having the government do it?
That would be hunting from a helicopter, though.
I don't know if that classifies as hunting. I don't think the state currently issues tags to go hunt horses, wild horses in central Utah.
Well, at any rate, there it was interesting to see that there was some opposition to this amendment.
The opposition is just suggests that the amendment is superfluous. That basically it doesn't really have an effect on things. And why are we spending time kind of discussing the issue? Because it is it's in some ways, I think they were thinking it was a distraction.
Sure. And I do sometimes think there is an argument for this is superfluous, or it's a waste of the voters' time or waste of civic energies. But on the other hand, the question does sometimes come up, if you think it's superfluous, then why are you taking the time to oppose it?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great point.
Let's move on to Amendment F, the legislative session start date. Christopher, do you want to talk about this one a little bit?
This mainly allows more flexibility in allowing the legislature to set its own start date within the month of January. Right now, it specifies that it needs to be the fourth Monday. A few years ago, it was the third Monday, which led to another constitutional amendment to change to the fourth Monday because that interfered with the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. So this really just allows additional flexibility for the state legislature to adjust the starting date to its preferred starting date. Companion legislation would move it to the third Tuesday, the day after Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Now, there was some opposition to this change.
There was some concern about whether legislative staff would be able to have some of the information that the legislature needs to make good decisions if dates were changed around. They came back and said that wouldn't be a big deal for them. Other concerns are just regarding like the flexibility of the primary jobs of the legislature. Since we do have a part-time legislature, this may impact their availability for their primary job. Those were the primary concerns. Did I miss anything else, Sean?
Well, somebody spoke against on the floor because they like the certainty that a constitutional amendment provides, whereas the statutory allowance for changing the date would, you know, put that into question. It could change from one year to the next, and it would be very easy to do that in the legislative session or a special session.
All right, well, let's move on to the next one, Amendment G. And this is the hot potato in the group. Currently, we have in place a constitutional limitation that any revenues derived from income taxes in Utah must be used solely for public education or higher education. Now, a bit of history, and correct me if this is wrong, while the dedication for public education goes quite a ways back and perhaps to the very earliest days of the income tax here, the provision covering higher education is of more recent vintage. So we've already had an expansion in recent decades of the use of income tax from just public education to also include higher education. This amendment would simply expand the named potential uses of that revenue further to include support services and programs for children and people with disabilities.
The reason I think this has come about is due to the limited number or amount of funding available from the general fund, which is from primarily from sales tax. And the idea here is that it'll allow you to use education funding for things like some of those things that we've been using general fund monies for in the past. And the reason why we need to do this is we've seen an increase in the education fund, continual increase over decades. And in fact, we cut the income tax in the mid-2000s because it was high, and we actually made a very small adjustment to the income tax more recently. With the general fund, we've actually seen it hasn't been growing kind of in step with needs. And that's in part because, you know, we're spending money on different things. We used to buy a bunch of food and cars and clothes, and now we're getting a lot more services and things that are untaxed. And so we're seeing that maybe we need a little bit more flexibility there. And the legislature spent a lot of time putting together a tax reform that then they kind of had to unwind because there was a backlash, and much of that backlash was really related to the sales tax on food that was as part of that tax reform package. And so they're just looking for some flexibility here. I guess the opposition says, hey, you know, we've got this gigantic earmark of the income tax that we've been using on education and post-secondary kind of education, like tech colleges and universities and colleges, and we want to maintain that, but the other side says, you know, we really need the flexibility that this amendment would allow the legislature when they're putting budgets together.
So Sean, one of the comments that we've heard about this is that the current constitutional language already defines public education, you know, for these revenue dedication purposes related to the income tax. It already defines public education broadly, because it says that when you look at the definition, it includes all public elementary and secondary schools and such other schools and programs as the legislature may designate. And so the argument is that, well, you know, we could already use income tax revenues beyond education. What do you think about that comment?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, like, the language, this for children and people with disabilities is pretty vague, but the language that was there before was kind of vague. Like, these other programs, what are these other programs? Are these programs to build roads? Or, you know, like, there is potentially some flexibility there, though. The issue is that I think for such a long time, those funds have been used solely for educational purposes, that if a legislature came in and voted on a bill to spend some of that education fund money on Medicaid, for instance, I think you may see some people pushing back against that with lawsuits and otherwise. And so they figure, well, if we can get the voters to kind of open this up a little bit with some constitutional amendment language, then we don't have to worry as much about the legal ramifications of that.
I have a question for Sean here, based on what he was talking about. If the goal here was to create additional flexibility, why not just get rid of the revenue guarantee for schools entirely? Why only open it up to children and individuals with disabilities?
Politics?
Oh, I think it's, you know, that's absolutely politics. This is if you're going to be marketing something, I would do it to vulnerable populations. Like, oh, you know, we got to help the children. We got to help people with disabilities. You don't go in and say, hey, we're going to get rid of this earmark and that has been benefiting children and education for decades. So I think absolutely it's a political strategy.
And Christopher, you know, that brings up an interesting point about this, just stepping back a bit and looking at the big picture. You know, if the amendment is designed to provide the state with greater budgetary flexibility, you know, what in the tax policy world out there, you know, what do you think would be the general perceptions of taking your entire income tax stream as a state and dedicating it to just education?
So earmarks or like these revenue dedications are pretty uncommon, especially really big ones. Often revenue dedications, it's the revenue that's brought in is tightly linked to how the revenue should be, needs to be spent, I guess. So like one really good example is hunting and fishing licenses. When the state sells licenses to hunt and fish, it dedicates that revenue to preserving wildlife. It's a really tight link between the how the money comes in and what the money should be used for. Another good example here in Utah is the gas tax. You know, the gas tax to some degree measures how many cars are driving on the road, and that kind of to some degree is linked to how much money we need to spend on the roads. So when there are these revenue dedications, people often try to link them between how much revenue is generated and kind of what the need is. The interesting thing about this revenue dedication is it's totally unrelated to educational need. I mean, so we could be going through a severe recession like we did in 2008, where there were decreases in the growth of state income taxes, but we still continue to have a growing need to support education during those time periods. Arguably even more because more people tended to go back to college to try and earn additional degrees. It certainly removes a lot of flexibility. One story I like to tell is about one of the earliest Utah Foundation studies looked at the newly implemented, back in the 1940s, looked at the newly implemented sales tax, which was expressly dedicated to only help those in poverty, those who were really suffering from the Great Depression. But then it turns out after the post-war boom, the sales tax was bringing in all this money, but suddenly there weren't that many people living in poverty anymore because, you know, the post-war boom had really raised all the boats. So we had all this money, but such a small need. And kind of we see this problem of how revenue dedications don't exactly match the need. And so there's a strong argument in this case that this revenue dedication doesn't really match this need. And there's probably better ways of doing that. And also allowing for greater flexibility to use these funds where there is a need or where it can meet larger different needs.
Now there is, you know, the counterpoint here that, as people often like to point out, Utah spends the least per pupil in the country and for K-12 students and on the operational side. And so, you know, why on earth would we ever want to do anything to have less protection for education funding? But interestingly, and maybe you could talk about this a little bit too, Christopher, this is a revenue dedication. That's not the same as dedicating an actual amount of funding. Some have pointed out that, you know, you could just cut the income tax rate in half, and thereby you would be cutting education funding significantly. You know, some states don't have income tax at all. And then we've also previously documented how there's a kind of a budgetary shell game, for better or worse, that you can play with the education funding, because there's also funding for higher education coming from the general fund. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Christopher?
So back before 1996, all of the income tax was dedicated just to public education, the kindergarten through 12th grade schools. In 1996, Utah passed a constitutional amendment that opened that up to public education, which previously had all been funded using general funds. And so that created this program, higher education, that kind of straddled both revenue streams. The revenue from the income tax, you could fund it with revenue from the income tax or revenue from the sales tax. And so over the years, it's kind of shifted or back and forth. But as kind of the sales tax revenue has remained the same, you know, per person by accounting for inflation, while income tax revenues have actually increased. And so it's become easier and easier to for that funding to kind of shift over to the income tax. And now, kind of recently, we've hit this point where almost all of it is funded by the income tax, and it removes the flexibility that this program had by straddling both income sources. And so essentially what this constitutional amendment is it's opening up another source of, it's opening up another two programs essentially to that kind of will do the same thing. They'll straddle both income sources, either through the income tax or through the sales tax. So they can kind of juggle money back and forth. And it's kind of a way to sidestep the fact that income revenue doesn't actually make it to the general fund. It's kind of a way to add some it's add some way to add some flexibility to the state's funding.
Now, up to this point, we've been talking just about what the constitutional amendment itself would do. And that's important because that's what the voters are voting on. With that said, this is actually part of a larger bargain that involves a piece of legislation, or multiple pieces of legislation, in fact, that are meant to protect and, in fact, bolster education funding, or funding for K-12 education anyway. Sean, can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, so you'd mentioned, Peter, that the that this idea of this earmark, it means that we've got a dedicated revenue source, but not a certain level of funding. What the companion legislation does is it says, hey, we're going to put into statute that we're going to provide for student enrollment growth and inflation. We're going to provide for this education stabilization kind of rainy day fund, and we're going to see an increase in education funding beyond that growth and inflation of 6% over the next few years. And so that's kind of like the carrot for getting into this. It's like, you know, ultimately, if you look back at the last 25 years since the last time voters talked about a constitutional amendment related to the education fund, we've actually seen a decrease in education funding effort that's steadily decreasing. We used to be, in terms of proportion of personal income, we were seventh in the nation, and now we're way down into the low 30s in the nation in terms of this kind of educational funding effort, which is the way we look at this. That dedication of the earmark of a source of funding hasn't maybe really worked in terms of increasing funding. And you mentioned also that we're last per pupil in operational spending. So maybe the idea is, what if we take this other approach where we run some legislation that puts some assurances that we'll see an increase in education funding going forward. The funny thing is that, you know, you could pass these bills without a constitutional amendment. It is basically they're dangling a bit of a carrot to say, you know, we're committing hopefully some future legislatures to putting this funding in place, while at the same time we're creating some flexibility for this source of revenue.
It's exchanging a revenue guarantee with whatever flaws it has for a funding promise, and they're asking the public to trust them with greater flexibility and also over the budget, or rather over revenues, but also to trust them to keep education funding strong, particularly K-12 education funding strong.
I think that's a perfect summary. And you know, you have this revenue constitutional kind of funding source guarantee, and we're trading that to a certain extent for this assurance. But you know, if you see a future legislature or some future legislators try to cut into this statutory funding guarantee assurance, I think you'd probably see some backlash from some people. And so maybe that promise will really hold legislators' feet to the fire, and we'll continue to see this increase in educational funding into the future. But at the same time, that's not going to, you know, we brought up this last in the nation for operational revenue. It's certainly not going to suddenly make us not last in the nation. I mean, maybe one day we'll beat Idaho, but we're so far away from most states that it's unlikely we're going to suddenly be funding schools and they're all going to be flush with cash.
And we should point out too that the constitutional amendment, again, it's not removing the dedication of income tax revenue. It's just expanding, or if you like, diluting it among other uses. It's not as though the revenue guarantee for education completely disappears. It's just that revenue could now potentially be used for a broader range of things.
But one thing to keep in mind is this revenue dedication is a constitutional amendment. To change this constitutional amendment, they have to go through this change process. It's a much higher bar to change this revenue dedication.
Yes.
And it will be to change this future funding dedication. The future funding dedication could be altered by just a majority vote of future legislators. On the other hand, you know, you could argue that that is pretty similar to already being true, because the legislature can simply lower income tax rates by a simple majority vote as well. To some degree, that, you know, this promise of a constitutional revenue guarantee isn't necessarily as strong as it maybe initially seems.
So let's imagine that 10 years down the line, the legislature and the state of Utah, the people of the state of Utah, have different priorities than they have today. And they want to dispense with these promises that are being made about education funding. Or maybe further down the line, there are fewer children or whatever the case may be, the way of education is delivered changes. The fact that it is in legislation does provide the flexibility to respond rapidly to changing conditions. That's both the danger, and that's in terms of responding to changing political conditions, but also the advantage in responding to changing necessities.
Peter pointed out in a discussion we had earlier, in the early 2000s, nobody would have expected, you know, the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 and the impact that would have had. And even as we are emerging from the Great Recession, you know, in 2015 with our roaring economy, no one could have predicted the global pandemic we're facing today. So there's definitely something to be said for flexibility. You know, on the other hand, you know, Utahns have certain priorities that they consider long-term priorities that they want the state legislature to be bound to. And it makes, you know, there's also a place for constitutional guidelines to make sure that legislators follow long-term priorities of the people. So there's definitely a balance to be struck there.
And let's be clear about this. Our own priority survey shows, and this crosses party lines, Republican, Democrat, unaffiliated, that a high priority of Utahns is K-12 education. And that's been the case in past surveys we've done as well.
Yeah, I mean, so K-12 education is usually among the top three items on the survey that we've conducted back to 2004. So it's definitely a long-term priority, and it's definitely a priority that all parties agree on is something that's very important.
And let's play devil's advocate here for a second. If the perspective currently is that, okay, well, we're not spending enough on K-12 education. We're not saying that. We're saying that perspective certainly exists out there. Perhaps it's almost a point of civic pride that we don't want to be last in the nation in per pupil operational spending. But if that's your perspective, then it stands to reason that you would say, well, why should we amend the Constitution to allow other uses for this revenue if we're so committed to spending on K-12 education? We should be spending what we're already spending under the dedication and under the revenue dedication, and then some. What would be the counterpoint to that, do you think?
I think the one of the best counterpoint to that is looking at our actual outcomes. So if you compare Utah's educational outcomes to other states like us, we're kind of right in the middle of the pack, you know. So there's something to be said for Utah being able to provide a fairly good education with very limited funds.
Sure, Sean, you were the principal author of a report that revealed last year that even though we're spending the least operationally, when you compare us to peer states that are maybe spending as much as twice as much as us, our outcomes are quite similar.
Yeah, I guess the question is, you know, are we satisfied? And maybe we are satisfied. Like, you know, the governor says we get good bang for the buck. Are we satisfied with the educational outcomes we have? Or could we with some additional targeted funding, reach out to some kids that need a little bit extra help, maybe with, even if it's just after school help or pulling kids out of classes and or whatever the most effective kind of interventions are. And then we suddenly have a group of students in Utah that compares much better nationally, and really just helps a whole host of additional kids with a step up that they may not get otherwise. Yeah, I guess the question is: Are we satisfied? Are we satisfied with being pretty good at a good really super bargain rate, or do we want to maybe target some funds to really have a positive effect on a certain subset of the population, maybe?
So the idea is that maybe we could have the best schools in the whole United States, rather than just performing well among peer states. We could maybe, if we spent some more money and spent it very wisely, that we would suddenly be competing for the number one spot in terms of outcomes in the country. Is that the notion?
Yeah, possibly. And maybe we wouldn't be spending as much as some of those states that are doing really well. Maybe we don't have to spend as much as Massachusetts to be Massachusetts, because we're already a lean machine. And maybe there are some ways we can target some funding and really approach the outcomes that that states like, Massachusetts, which is pretty highly regarded in the education community, maybe we can approach what they are accomplishing there.
Sure. Well, I know we could keep on talking about this. Are there any other important points that you think we ought to bring up? Christopher, you look like you've got something.
I've got something to bring up. Just one point to consider about this. If this amendment doesn't pass, all of this money will continue to be dedicated to either K-12 education or higher education. If this amendment does pass, it opens up the ability to shift some of those revenues over to programs that help children and those with disabilities. Like some of those revenues will be redirected. Otherwise, there'd be no purpose in passing this amendment at all. The point is, they're opening up a spigot, right? They're putting in an additional spigot. No, right now we have two spigots. They're putting in a third.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Thank you, gentlemen. And again, Utah Foundation takes no position on any of these items. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks.
This has been Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. Follow our work at utahfoundation.org.